How are you guys tonight? Yeah. Good? Thank you so much for coming and supporting this event. It's very important event, and it's very good to have you here. Every time I call home, usually the usual conversation is I'd say hello, and you know, my whoever answers the phone would say, "Ahlan, Habibti, how are you today?" And I would say, "Good, good. Where are you?" I'm like, "Are you in New York?" I'd say, "Yes, I'm in New York. How are you? How are you?" Before you tell me, you have to come very soon to Palestine. We have very good mishmish, apricot jam, shish berek wedding for you. Come. Are you settled yet? No children? Haram. This is our customary conversation about every week. But then I would tell him, of course, how are you? And he would say, very bad. I'm like, what do you mean? What happened from last week? Things are worse. Unfortunately, usually things are. When I last went in February, March, it was one of the hardest trips. I mean, in the last, you know, especially since the second intifada, every time I go, things have gotten worse and worse. This last trip when I went, I landed in Ben Gurion Airport, and of course they have a new airport, a very beautiful new airport, and you always have very mixed feeling when you're landing there. Of course, after 4 or 5 hours waiting, I go outside and I drive to my hometown, Bethlehem, and this time the wall was up, completely up, with a new security check. You know, it's not really a checkpoint. It's basically like entering a prison, and they have this big sign that says, "Peace be upon you." So I enter Bethlehem, and of course, this town is a very tiny town, and not only has Bethlehem shrunk, but also we feel it incredible, because unlike, for example, even Ramallah, you don't see the wall as much like in Bethlehem. You really feel the wall. And I go to see the schools and the children, because that's where life is. And just like in the Beirut war, which was basically children who died and women, in Palestine, it's the children. And I go speak to them. And most of the new generation have never been to Jerusalem. When I ask them what they want to do, they, you know, what is their dream? They say, "I would like to go to Al-Quds, to Jerusalem," which is only 15 minutes away, and it's a sister city to Bethlehem, really. And now we don't have no access to it. And I look at these kids, and I don't know what to tell them when they ask me, "You do so much. I want to do that much," and I don't know how to respond to that. And the feelings are very difficult. There's 3.5, we hear about dialogue tonight. There's 3.5 million people behind a wall. And with a wall, I don't see how we can dialogue. This is a poem against the wall. Every day a crueler hour. The fencing of hearts barely beating. The palpitation of leaves in our dry garden. The heat in Gaza, in Jericho. Keeping dreams we never had the time to remember. An old woman trying to revive any fantasy she can. Another thinking of her husband lost nowhere she can imagine. Men over barbed wires who stop answering when we scream their name. Too busy trying to cross the checkpoints, the soldiers, the day, the night. While others drink tea, talk about curfews, women, the children they buried. While a mother asks what she will tell the child inside of her that she wish it did not come. We witness October in flames, and every other month following is the same. The streets we walk through, a reminder of who we are and what they will never make of us. Human portraits in corners we forget to look at or forget to reach. Pictures stuck on walls as if they belong nowhere. A groom and a bride forced to wed anywhere but where they should. And yet we keep asking what victory blows candles out, what sea speaks of another sea. Even if they raise the wall higher than we can reach, we only know one home, even if we take different routes each time. The tree guides us. The wind guides us. The sun and the moon guide us. And when we arrive, we find the books we cannot stop reading, the embroideries the refugees made, the kitchen where our lives were lived, a marriage proposal, a death, a birth. And every day, as we brew our morning coffee, we greet each other properly and chase the wall from our breath. Thank you. And I'm just going to end with one short poem for peace. Even. Nothing is even. Even this line I'm writing. Even this line I'm waiting in. Waiting for permission to enter the country, the house, the room. Nothing is even. Even now that laws have been drawn and peace is discussed on high tables. And even if all was said to be even, I would not believe. For even I know that nothing is even. Not the trees, the flowers, not the mountains or the shadows. Our nature is not even. So why even try to get even? Instead, let us find an even better place and call it even. Thank you so much.
I'm Benny Kirschenbaum. I'm going to read an essay of Natalia Ginsburg's that was written during the time that she and her family were in exile in the Abruzzi from Rome. And I'm just going to read pieces of it, but I think I put them together in a way that makes sense. When I first came to the village, all the faces seemed the same to me. The women, rich and poor, young and old, all looked alike. Nearly all had missing teeth. The women down there lose their teeth at 30 from hard work and poor nutrition, as well as from the strains of childbirth and nursing babies that come one after the other relentlessly. As the first snows began to fall, a slow sadness took hold of us. Our lot was exile. Our city was far away. Our books, our friends, the shifting ups and downs of a real existence, all far away. We would light our green stove with the long pipe running across the ceiling. We used to gather in the room with the stove. We cooked and ate there. My husband wrote at the big oval table, and the children scattered their toys on the floor. A picture of an eagle was painted on the ceiling, and I would stare at the eagle, thinking that that was exile. Exile was the eagle. It was the humming green stove. It was the vast, silent countryside and the motionless snow. At 5 o'clock, the bells of the Church of Santa Maria rang, and the women with their black shawls and red faces went to prayers. Every evening, my husband and I took a walk. Every evening, arm in arm, our feet plunged in snow. The people on our street were all friendly and familiar and would come to their doors to greet us. A good evening to you. Now and then, someone would ask, "Well, when are you going back home?" My husband would say, "When the war is over." "And when will this war be over? You're a professor. You know everything. When will it be over?" In winter, some old person would die of pneumonia. The bells of Santa Maria tolled the death knell, and Domenico Oreccio, the carpenter, built a casket. A woman went crazy and was taken to the asylum at Calamaggio, and the whole town talked about it for quite a while. She was young and clean, the cleanest woman in the village. They said that must have been because of her great cleanliness. Rosa, the school caretaker, had a neighbor who spit in her eye, and she went around with a bandage on it in order to collect damages. "Eyes are sensitive and spit is salty," she explained. And they talked about this for quite some time, too, until there was nothing left to say. We grew more homesick every day. Letters from our city came bearing news of weddings and deaths we couldn't take part in. At times, the nostalgia turned sharp and bitter, turned into hatred. But we kept this hatred hidden, knowing it to be unjust. I told the children about our city. They were very small when we left and had no memories of it. I told them how the houses had many floors and there were lots of streets and buildings and beautiful stores. "But here we have Giraud's," the children said. Giraud's shop was right opposite our house. Giraud stood in the doorway like an old owl, his round, impassive eyes fixed on the street. He sold a little of everything: groceries, candles, postcards, shoes, oranges. In February, the air grew damp and soft. Heavy gray clouds drifted across the sky. The end of winter awakened a vague restlessness in us. Maybe someone would come to visit. Maybe something would finally happen. Surely our exile, too, must have an end. There is a certain dull uniformity in human destiny. The course of our lives follow ancient and immutable laws with an ancient, changeless rhythm. Dreams never come true, and the instant our dreams are shattered, we realize how the greatest joys of our life lie beyond the realm of reality. The instant they are shattered, we are sick with longing for the days when they flamed within us. Our fate spends itself in this succession of hope and nostalgia. My husband died in Regina Coeli prison in Rome a few months after we left the village. When I confront the horror of his solitary death, of the anguished choices that preceded his death, I have to wonder if this really happened to us. We who bought oranges at Giraud's and went walking in the snow. I had faith then in a simple, happy future, rich with fulfilled desires, with shared experiences and ventures. But that winter in the Abruzzi was the best time of my life, and only now, now that it's gone forever, do I know it. Thanks.
I'd like to introduce the next reader. Bernice is going to begin now. Bernice, I'm going to give the microphone to you.
Hi, good evening. Thank you all for coming out tonight. I'm very happy to be a part of this. I often wonder sometimes when I watch the news, and I try not to watch the news, that our creator must be very miffed with us. But then you have events like this, and I think that puts a smile on his face. I'm going to read a poem by Marjorie Stamm Rosenfeld. It's called Thirst. And it begins this way. Beneath the Holy Land, where even water wars are fought, the troubled springs run deep, and water, which has properties to wear on stone, has split the rock. Lord, my shepherd. About suffering, Stephen Grass said, suffering is like salt, bitter in a glass. Become a lake instead, then sip the water. You'll see how sweet it tastes, with hardly any hint of bitterness. The Jaffa oranges are sweet and bigger than grenades. We've moved our fences farther in. Our neighbors claim the land we left, then ours. Besides the still waters, Sbarro Pizza, where a young man opens his coat, says to the girl behind the counter, know what this is? So like the exhibitionist who bears his misused, misplaced instrument of love explosively, he maketh me to lie down in green pastures. Tents of Palestinians are buffeted by angry winds. Their throats are parched. The houses of Palestinians collapse in the house of the Lord. Another scene. From one side comes a swarthy man. From the other, one more swarthy man, sons of the same father. They face off, raise their instruments, and aim. Which will give ground? Which will strike the other first? Raging thirst propels them. Nearby, the only lake that's fresh and clear is Lake Tiberias, called the Sea of Galilee. It, too, is troubled water. Further south, the sea is dead and full of salt. How many Abrahamic sons must fall? Bombs bloom. The wolves that used to roam the Russian steppes are here, through the Valley of the Shadow. A great tree arches over the River Jordan. It is the tree of the Jewish people. It is the tree of the Palestinian people. Its leaves shudder in the wind. On every leaf, a name. Thank you.
I'm Evelyn Shaker, and I'm going to be reading from an autobiographical essay that is called At Home and Away, 13 Takes on Growing Up Arab in America. And in my case, that means Lebanese because my parents were immigrants from Lebanon. And it's as you can tell from the title, divided into sections that are relatively disjointed. I'm not going to read the whole essay. I'll only read a few sections that I thought might be in keeping with the theme tonight, sections that indicate how from my childhood, from a very early age, what we call the conflict in the Middle East was a part of my consciousness. It was something that even a child could not escape. And also, the sections also show, I think, that although we were a very closely knit, tightly knit community, nevertheless, there were from time to time individual Jewish people who came within the orbit of our family and our community, and somehow that was okay. We made peace with that. So I'm going to begin with the second section, actually. My uncle Yusuf, a gentleman, loved America, but hated Catholics, Democrats, and Jews. Mention the Pope to him, he'd come close to spitting. Jews, of course, were the usurpers, planting themselves on Arab land, which explained too his venom towards Democrats, and Harry Truman in particular, who'd waited all of 11 minutes before saying yes when Jews in Palestine declared themselves a state. My uncle Yusuf loved his suburban garden. He grew vegetables for his wife and flowers for the joy of it. Flashy blooms, dahlias, giant chrysanthemums, and ruffled peonies. He cradled their heads in his huge hands. He cooed to them like a lover. Their enemies were his enemies. He picked off Japanese beetles with his bare fingers and drowned them in a can of kerosene. He called them Trumans. My Uncle Yusuf loved me. One day, when it was just the two of us in his car, he asked the standard question, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" To be funny, I said, "President." He said, "Why not?" A window in my mind flew open. I began to think things I'd never thought before. This is section three. To American diplomats who urged Truman to hold off on recognizing Israel, he cited the wishes of American Jews. "I am sorry, gentlemen, but I have to answer to hundreds of thousands who are anxious for the success of Zionism. I do not have hundreds of thousands of Arabs among my constituents." On a Christmas show back in the 50s, Perry Como croons carols on TV, but also works in Jewish folk songs. My father, passing through the living room, overhears. "Jews," he explodes, "do they control everything?" I go into my bedroom and slam the door. Only years after he died did I begin to understand what it felt like for my father to be an Arab in the United States, reminded in every editorial on every channel that on matters that mattered, he could have no political voice. Good that he didn't live to see 67 and Israel's six-day blitzkrieg against Syria and Egypt, when newsmen and even comics on American TV gloated openly at Israel's victory, when Arabs were mocked pitilessly. Four, the early 70s, Palestinians are hijacking airliners and planting bombs. After one horrific attack, I'm on a bus riding through a Boston neighborhood where Syrians and Lebanese have lived for decades. An old man climbs on. He is drunk and disheveled. "Oh, Arabs," he cries out in Arabic, swaying from one overhead strap to another. His tears spill. "Oh, brothers, what have you done?" The driver, who has understood nothing, mutters an ethnic epithet and puts him off the bus. Five. My father's best fishing buddy was Mr. Rosenfield, who sold silk ties and held his pants up with suspenders. Before dawn on a Saturday, his black Pontiac would drive down our street, and my father, who'd been at the window watching for headlights, would flick off the porch light and be out the door. Gear loaded, the two were off for the day, out after white perch and striped bass, freshwater fish. Forget the sea. Cape Cod had 365 bodies of water, my father claimed, a new one for each day of the year. When they arrived at their special spot, the sun just rising, the morning mist still on the lake, they spread out along the shore in opposite directions. Mirror images, clumsy figures in waist-high fishermen's boots, wading cautiously into water. Product of shtetl or mountain, neither man knew how to swim, but they knew rule number one: don't talk, don't call out, don't scare the fish. At noon, under a fringe of trees, they unrolled a patchwork blanket of wool remnants my mother had pieced together on her sewing machine, pulled out sandwiches wrapped in wax paper, fried eggplant for my father, something that smelled of fish for Mr. Rosenfield, hard-boiled eggs, whole tomatoes they bit into like apples, thermoses of sweet black coffee, cinnamon buns picked up the day before from a favorite bakery. Afterwards, my father puffing on his pipe, Mr. Rosenfield his cigarette, they relaxed into conversation. What did they talk about then, this Arab and this Jew? Rods and reels, maybe. Lures and live bait. Irish politicians. Thank you.
Hi, I am Wendy Orange. Too loud, okay? I have to say this has been fantastic. I lived in Israel for 9 years in the 90s. And then my daughter got dyslexic and we had to come back. And it was kind of a nightmare for me to leave Israel. I waited 9 years for her to go to college. I moved back last June. And things are so bad over there that all of our races and all of us here can have conversations that we no longer can have there. Most of my book, which I am supposed to read from, is about dialogue work in Nablu, in Beit Sahor, in Jerusalem. Amazing, amazing stories. And I want to thank you, I'm not good with names, for bringing me back to dialogue because it was amazing. And all of you who read were just great. And by the way, the Palestinian woman from Bethlehem, that first phone call with your family was so Jewish. And that's what we learned in dialogue. I also... Yes.
I have to concur with that. My family would have said the exact same thing. Thank you.
Anybody else want to get up? Because I'm very happy to give up my place. I want to introduce one of my best friends, Lily Rivlin, who's here tonight. Her film, she's made many films, but her film that was shown at the Jerusalem Film Festival in June, this past June, is all about Palestinian and Israeli women activists. Would you stand, Lily? And thank you for coming. So she should feel right at home here. And, okay, now I took the 6 minutes very seriously. My book was out of print, and I just got the rights reverted to me. So, we're yes. I was going to read from the last chapter, which has Jews and Palestinians, Israelis and Palestinians, up on a hilltop during the building of what Israel calls Har Homa, and Palestinians call Abu Janim, but it was way too long. So then I came up with... The reason I wrote this book, it's called Rabin is Dead. My good friend, who does not want to be introduced, who is Israeli, time me. Blank, blank. So basically, we're not going to get much Rabin in. We're going to get a little of me in, that's all. You all do remember Rabin's death? Okay. So you're not going to get much of him, but read the chapter, and the last chapter is great. We're going to cut out a lot of it. Okay, can you hear me? One day, there is life, and then suddenly it happens, there is death. I'm in my Cambridge study, examining these words on the back jacket of Paul Auster's memoir, Invention of Solitude. 3:30 on a Saturday afternoon, November 4th, 1995. I flip back and forth from the book's opening passage back to this phrase on the cover, when the phone rings. My best friend Marge has just heard on BBC News that minutes ago Rabin was shot. They don't know if he'll live. I'm alone in the house, usually filled with Israelis and others. My dog Harry is lying beside me, asleep on the floor. I start howling, guttural sounds so loud that they seem to me to be coming from someone else. Harry slinks under the chair as Marge is still on the phone saying, "Are you okay?" shouting, "Are you okay?" On TV, Yitzhak Rabin is not yet dead, and then he is. Skip, 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 skip. Okay, don't skip. I try to get on an LL flight, and I quite love LL for security as well as for, it used to be just kind of wild and fun and nobody followed rules. And on this particular night, already immediately after his death, it was all filled. So I took a Swiss Air flight. It was the only flight left, and we stopped over in Zurich, in which I see Rabin's coffin coming up from Tel Aviv. And now I'm in Jerusalem. And lots happens in between, but not important. Okay. I go to visit my friend Yehuda, a painter who is often anti-Arab, then other times he's pro-Arab, and Arab is the word that people who really don't know the situation use for Palestinians. I try never to do that. Okay. And we start walking. Finally, we arrive at Rabin's coffin. It's brightly lit, circled by hundreds of lit candles, bouquets, handwritten letters. I myself write a farewell note after we stand at the closed coffin. We move on. I'm drawn to gaze up at the sky. In the almost full moon, Rabin's face seems to be shining down from that lunar surface. I stare at what remains of his determined expression, that trademark half-smile everybody remarks upon. The impression, sorely weird, is also soothing. Searching for our car, we climb along with hundreds of others over concrete sites, mounds of dirt and sand lit only by moonlight. As if choreographed, we move nimbly, like astronauts, I say to Yehuda, who looks around and nods. We all seem to be moving without gravity, without noise, without feeling, as if in layers of padded grief that are keeping all emotions at bay. I get into bed in Yehuda's guest loft, he's not my lover, just as dawn is rising. In this November heat wave, I hear the birds of Jerusalem, one of the most intimate sounds I know. Whenever I was in pain there, when I lived there permanently, I mean supposedly permanently, I was drawn to these unusually melodic little creatures, just little birds that hop merrily about. The birds are greeting this terrible day. Only I can't fall asleep. So I return to Auster's Invention of Solitude, picking up where I left off yesterday, what seems a month ago. I read over again. One day there is life, and then suddenly it happens, there is death. Skip, 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 skip. I never learned to write short. Okay. I wake each morning in morbid disbelief. I can't accept that Rabin is dead. One midday during the first week in Jerusalem, this first week of Shiva morning, I feel restless and drive aimlessly. Remember that I haven't spoken to a single Palestinian. So these were the days. I drive past Bethlehem's checkpoint and into the town of Beit Zahur, hoping to talk to the dialogue leaders who, in fact, are there, at a rapprochement center for dialogue which we built and which is no longer visited by anybody. After offering coffee and conversation, we sit comfortably and they tell me that the first phase of Oslo, this is not long after the handshake, 2 years after, phase one is proceeding since Rabin's death 5 days ago, with Israeli troops moving out of the cities of the West Bank before schedule instead of the usual stalling. Skip, skip. Okay, we're almost done. I learned that several of my oldest first Palestinian friends from Nablus, how do you say it in Arabic? Arabic? Say again?
Nablus.
How do you say Nablus in
Nablus.
Okay, fine. Okay, I have one paragraph. Okay, I learned that several of my best friends from Nablus, Palestinians, were given press passes, attended the priest's rally, after which Rabin was murdered. They heard the shot and felt the shockwaves. Okay, I'm over time, so I'm going to just read the very end. I'm back in Cambridge, Massachusetts, after 2 weeks in Israel, sitting at a low table facing a photo of Rabin, which I framed with fresh flowers, lit candles. The Shalom Chaver tapes that eulogize him in beautiful Hebrew music are playing in the background and played for the next 5 years for me. I'm trying to bring back the spirit, everything I saw in Jerusalem. I feel just like after my parents died, each died young, and after each death, it was as if the umbrella or the awning or whatever the metaphor is of my universe had been split open, allowing bursts of icy wind to rush in, a coldness that lowered the temperature in all the rest of my life. This coldness is what death leaves, especially the death of someone essential to the small world each of us holds close, figures, images, and mostly people who keep us intimate with life. Rabin, why was he part of my essential cosmos? Because the peace process he put in motion and the dialogue process that the people put in motion was central to my life. Skipping. I stare blankly at the table. My eyes land again on, actually it's called The Invention of Solitude, a book I've placed as a reminder of my time. I finished it in Jerusalem. I pick it up and turn to the last page. I see what I have to do now to honor Rabin, to give meaning to what he set in motion, to keep alive my years in Jerusalem. Oster did it. He paces his room in the last page, overwhelmed by grief. He finds words remote. He's unable to write what he knows. He's committing to do so. Writing will be my way too. Such a task seems as necessary as it is impossible. I reread the last lines of his memoir, his words. It was, it will never be again. Underline, remember.
Mine is very short. I'm Joan Silber. I'm sorry. What I'm reading to you was written, I and a bunch of other writers were asked to write a 3-minute piece on the subject of revenge. And my first draft was this little speech about why I was against revenge in all forms. And I quoted from a great speech that Al Gore gave around the time of Abu Ghraib, explaining why revenge was also very detrimental to the avenger. But it turned out what I wrote wasn't what they wanted. They wanted something much more personal and anecdotal. So this is what I ended up writing. When I went to Vietnam as a tourist a few years ago, I visited the War Museum in Ho Chi Minh City, which is filled with photos of atrocities. It also has a room with pictures of protests all over the world. And I was initially eager to let people know I had been in those marches. I can't say that any Vietnamese I met was terribly impressed by this. One guide I said it to had just led a tour of American vets to meet Vietnamese who'd fought against them. The country's own scars of reunification made my volunteer memories very pale. I didn't mention to anyone until the end of my visit that I had an older brother who'd been in Vietnam as a civilian during the war. He was an engineer for a company that made guidance systems for aircraft, and he was sent to figure out why the planes weren't flying right. or so I understand it. My brother, who died 9 years ago, never spoke about it. The one letter he sent was after being shelled in Da Nang, so I did make a point of going to Da Nang. No one, including the taxi drivers at Da Nang Airport, could believe I was actually staying there. Though Da Nang has a great museum, it's a rundown, unpretty city, and tourists stay outside. Within an hour of my walking down the main street, everyone in town knew I was American. The news was spread by guys trying to sell me rides on the back of their motorcycles, the standard cheap taxis of Vietnam. Da Nang was the one place people talked about having been on the losing side in the war. One man in his 50s said he'd been a translator for the Americans. One kid in his 20s said his father and his uncle had fought on the southern side. This was an odd feeling for me because I wasn't on that side. You can hear, as I say this, the complications of that. My entanglements crossed each other by belief and by family, as they did for Vietnamese. The boy with relatives who'd fought for the South became my motorcycle chauffeur for a jaunt to Monkey Mountain. He pointed out the pink colonial structure that was his church and the club where he was a DJ at night, and he told me his uncle was in California now and his son was in the army in Iraq. He laughed, as maybe he had a right to, at what he had escaped and at the joke and its never being over. And he looked back at me, unsafely at that speed, to make sure I appreciated the endless, ironic revenge of history, which he was quite used to.
Good evening. My name is Kathy Salton, and I'd like to read a very brief excerpt from Israeli and Palestinian Voices. This is a book that was written after a visit I made to Israel-Palestine, where I interviewed Israelis and Palestinians. Palestinians must come to acknowledge Jewish fears and their need for security, while Israelis must recognize that the only authentic security for them is through justice for the Palestinians. A quote from Naim Atik, Canon of St. George Cathedral, Jerusalem. Peace between Israelis and Palestinians does not require them to agree on the events which comprise their respective histories. Instead, it necessitates a mutual acknowledgement of the injustices each has suffered. Last year at this time, the world witnessed an extraordinary event when, after 38 years of occupation, the Israeli government pulled 7,800 settlers out of the Gaza Strip without any serious incident. Many of the soldiers sympathetic to the settler movement and the violent protesters did not want to be seen ejecting fellow Jews from their homes. Yet they performed their duties admirably and with great care so as not to harm the civilian population. The world saw the power of moderation, transcending the forces of extremism, something which had rarely been seen before in Israel. As I watched the coverage on television, I imagined how wonderful it would be if the same moderation were extended to Palestinian civilians at the military checkpoints. In my mind's eye, I saw an Israeli soldier apologizing to a Palestinian man twice his size for having to carry out a body search, or to an old woman obliged to wait hours in a long line in the hot sun. For one fleeting moment, I dared to dream of a day when both peoples would dwell side by side in peace. After all, Jews and Arabs are both indigenous to the Holy Land. And since ancient times have lived as neighbors and often as close relatives through intermarriage. Why then, in the 21st century, is our thinking not more sophisticated? Why can we not create the same amicable living conditions that existed for long periods in ancient times. If the events of the recent years is any indication, it appears that neither the Palestinians nor the Israelis are acting in a reasonable way to make peace happen. In March of 2002, while I was in Jerusalem in the West Bank, Palestinian suicide bombers killed a record 108 Israelis. These human bombs chose to carry out their deadly missions in crowded malls, pizza parlors, and neighborhood cafes. That month, their favorite target appeared to be buses. Bombers chose mornings when the city buses were crowded with students on their way to school, and evenings when commuters were returning home to their families. Because March was unusually hot that year, most bus drivers closed the windows, turned on the air conditioning, which only intensified the blasts and maximized the number of victims. Suicide bombers strap homemade explosives to their torsos. Their bombs are made, packed with bolts, nuts, screws, and pieces of broken machinery capable of inflicting maximum bodily damage in a blast. The explosion, powerful enough to plunge metal shards through necks and rip open major arteries, transforms the bus into an inferno of twisted metal and burning flesh. Under Israel's unilateral withdrawal, their unilateral withdrawal in August of 2005, Khan Yunis was one of 8 refugee camps in the Gaza Strip, where 58,891 Palestinians lived in a very small area, making it the most densely populated place on earth. Khan Yunis is a concrete shantytown. Sewage runs in rivulets down the middle of alleyways. There are no gardens, no places for children to play other than the dunes in front of the neighboring Israeli settlements, which together with the military installations surround Khan Yunis on 3 sides. The dunes dotted on the tops with Israeli gun emplacements and sand-bagged bunkers are surrounded by an electric fence. Israeli soldiers routinely taunt young boys who like to fly their kites along the perimeter of the fence, with racial slurs and invective meant to produce an angry response. The boys run up the sloping dunes to the fence and throw stones, to which the Israeli soldiers reply with their weapons of choice, dart-like needles known as flechettes, which are packed inside shells. On impact, the flechettes spray out a deadly mass, slicing the targets to pieces. In one 24-hour period, Israeli soldiers killed 14 Palestinian children, all under the age of 14. Chris Hedges, Middle East reporter for the New York Times, witnessed such an incident. "Children have been shot in other conflicts I've covered, but I have never before watched soldiers entice children like mice into a trap and then murder them on the spot." Currently, there are approximately 5 million Israelis and 4.8 million Palestinians living in Israel proper in the occupied territories. Since these two peoples are not going to disappear, they must find a way to make compromises in exchange for peace.
Thank you all for your support for Seeds of Peace, and thank you for your attention. Johnny Got His Gun is a novel by Dalton Trumbo. It was written in 1938. He was 20 years old. It was at the printer when World War II began, so it was published in a very different climate than the one in which it was written. It was soon after that serialized in the Daily Worker. And it's a novel that's had a curious history because each decade brings a new context for this important novel. Dalton Trumbo himself was blacklisted. The novel was out of print for many years. It had a renaissance at the time of the Vietnam War when there was yet again a new context for thinking about the way Dalton Trumbo wrote about World War I. There was also a movie in 1970. Johnny Got His Gun is about a soldier, a private from a small town in America, who is blown up in the trenches in France. And the entire novel takes place in his mind because he has had his arms amputated and his legs amputated and his face has been blown away and he's deaf and he's blind. So he's just lying in a bed. And the entire novel is his consciousness, his experience, his narrative of how he figures out how he got here. And over a period of years, he sustains himself thinking and understanding. And he develops, finally, a way to communicate using Morse code by moving his head on the pillow. And he communicates his desire, because he's got this worked out, that he would like to travel around the world as an educational exhibit of war. And he is told that this is against regulations and is not permitted, and drugged, and he feels them drugging him. And now, for the first time, he truly despairs and goes mad. This denial drives him mad. And this is how the novel concludes. Why didn't they want him? Why were they shutting the lid of the coffin against him? Why didn't they want him to speak? Why didn't they want him to be seen? Why didn't they want him to be free? It was 5, maybe 6 years now since he had been blown out of the world. The war must be over by now. No war could last that long, killing so many people. There wouldn't be enough people to kill. If the war was over, then all the dead had been buried and all the prisoners had been released. Why shouldn't he be released too? Why not, unless they figured him as one of the dead? And if that was true, why didn't they kill him? Why didn't they put a stop to his suffering? Why should he be a prisoner? He had committed no crime. What right had they to keep him? What possible reason could they have to be so inhuman to him? Why? And then suddenly he saw. He had a vision of himself as a new kind of Christ, as a man who carries within himself all the seeds of a new order of things. He was the new Messiah of the battlefields, saying to people, as I am, so shall you be. For he had seen the future, he had tasted it, and now he was living it. He had seen the airplanes flying in the sky, he had seen the skies of the future filled with them, black with them, and now he saw the horror beneath. He saw a world of lovers forever parted of dreams, never consummated of plans that never turned into reality. He saw a world of dead fathers and crippled brothers and crazy screaming sons. He saw a world of armless mothers clasping headless babies to their breasts, trying to scream out their grief from throats that were cancerous with gas. He saw starved cities black and cold and motionless, and the only things in this whole dead, terrible world that made a move or a sound were the airplanes that blackened the sky and far off against the horizon, the thunder of the big guns and the puffs that rose from barren, tortured earth when their shells exploded. That was it. He had it. He understood it now. He had told them his secret, and in denying him, they had told him theirs. He was the future. He was a perfect picture of the future, and they were afraid to let anyone see what the future was like. Already they were looking ahead. They were figuring the future, and somewhere in the future they saw war. To fight that war, they would need men, and if men saw the future, they wouldn't fight. So they were masking the future. They were keeping the future a soft, quiet, deadly secret. They knew that if all the little people, all the little guys saw the future, they would begin to ask questions. They would ask questions, and they would find answers, and they would say to the guys who wanted them to fight, they would say, you lying, thieving sons of bitches, we won't fight. We won't be dead. We will live. We are the world. We are the future. We will not let you butcher us no matter what you say, no matter what speeches you make, no matter what slogans you write. Remember it well. We are the world. We are what makes it go round. We make bread and cloth and guns. We are the hub of the wheel and the spokes and the wheel itself. Without us, you would be hungry, naked worms, and we will not die. We are immortal. We are the sources of life. We are the lowly, despicable, ugly people. We are the great, wonderful, beautiful people of the world, and we are sick of it. We are utterly weary. We are done with it forever and ever because we are the living, and we will not be destroyed. If you make a war, if there are guns to be aimed, if there are bullets to be fired, if there are men to be killed, they will not be us. They will not be us, the guys who grow wheat and turn it into food, the guys who make clothes and paper and houses and tiles, the guys who build dams and power plants and string the long moaning high tension wires, the guys who crack crude oil down into a dozen different parts, who make light globes and sewing machines and shovels and automobiles and airplanes and tanks and guns. Oh, no, it will not be us who die. It will be you. It will be you. You who urge us on to battle. You who incite us against ourselves. You who would have one cobbler kill another cobbler. You who would have one man who works kill another man who works. You who would have one human being who wants only to live, kill another human being who wants only to live. Remember this. Remember this well, you people who plan for war. Remember this, you patriots, you fierce ones, you spawners of hate, you inventors of slogans. Remember this as you have never remembered anything else in your lives. We are men of peace, we are men who work, and we want no quarrel. But if you destroy our peace, if you take away our work, if you try to range us one against the other, we will know what to do. If you tell us to make the world safe for democracy, we will take you seriously, and by God and by Christ, we will make it so. We will use the guns you force upon us. We will use them to defend our very lives, and the menace to our lives does not lie on the other side of a no man's land that was set apart without our consent. It lies within our own boundaries, here and now. We have seen it, and we know it. Put the guns into our hands, and we will use them. Give us the slogans, and we will turn them into realities. Sing the battle hymns, and we will take them up where you left off. Not one, not ten, not 10,000, not a million, not 10 millions, not 100 millions, but 1 billion, 2 billions of us, all the people of the world. We will have the slogans, and we will have the hymns, and we will have the guns, and we will use them, and we will live. Make no mistake of it, we will live. We will be alive, and we will walk and talk and eat and sing and laugh and feel and love and bear our children in tranquility and security and decency and peace. You plan the wars, you masters of men, plan the wars and point the way, and we will point the gun.
Bravo, Ms. Weber. I don't think I can say any more than that. That was absolutely it. Thank you so much for staying with us, for being here. I know I found it very healing. And just thank you. Peace among us.
This recording was made available by the New York Sound Posse, online at nysoundposse.com.